Environment Natural Resources Committee is open. This is what we're going to do, folks. We are going to start with House Bill 3481. Greg Peden, you're the only one signed up to testify. If it's all right with you, we're going to go straight to a work session and just pass the bill. And then we're going to go to 3469, and then we're going to go to 2723, and then finish up with Cougars and Bears. So with that, go straight to a work session on 3481A, if I could have a motion.
Did you want me to give a little summary?
Oh, yeah. We better put that on the record.
For the record. Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3481A establishes a task force on Oregon's hybrid poplar industry consisting of seven members appointed jointly by the Speaker of the House and the Senate President. Directs the task force to study hybrid poplar industry and review laws and rules, specifically those related to tax assessment and regulatory issues, and report back to an interim committee no later than December 1st, 2000.
All right, thank you. Committee, any discussion on the bill? Any objections? Seeing none, so. I'm sorry, we didn't get to that, did we? Go ahead. Yeah, give me a motion. I thought we did that and then did this. We didn't.
Yeah, please. House Bill 3481 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Byer. 3481A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now, any discussion? And any objections? You sure you look like you're chomping?
I was just going
to say,
I saw consent on here. I just figured that was a new procedure. No motion needed. We just go right.
Yeah, that's right. I don't even know why you guys showed up.
We are in the last days here. Okay?
All right.
We got to move these bills.
With no objections, so ordered. Senator Prozanski, why don't you carry that one?
Okay.
And with that, I will close the work session on 3481A. 3469, I'm going to open a work session on that as well. And Representative Cannon, are you here? You're not here yet. Yeah, somebody went to get Representative Cannon. Sue, why don't you give us an update on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3469 authorizes the Department of Human Services to grant variances from specified water treatment techniques when treatment is unnecessary for protecting public health, requires the department to announce its intent to grant the variance and either hold a public hearing or notify individual customers by mail or publish notice in the newspaper, requires the department to notify the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency if a variance is granted. And for the record, we've received four letters, all of them in support, from Dr. Catherine Thomason, who's with Physicians for Social Responsibility, Scott Fernandez of Portland, the Portland Water Users Coalition and Central Oregon Cities Organization in support, and Oregon Wild is also in support.
Committee, we'll stay. Since we are waiting and we're going to have the representative testify when he gets here, David Schaff, if you want to come up and say a couple quick things on the record, that's better than us just sitting here and waiting for the representative.
Good afternoon. Chair Avakian and members of the committee, I'm David Schaff. I'm the director of the Portland Water Bureau, and I'm here to testify today on House Bill 3469. We are here to express our support, the City of Portland's support, for this bill. If passed, the bill would grant the state drinking water program its full authority under federal law to issue variances to federal drinking water rules. Currently, the state Safe Drinking Water Act provides the states with authority to issue two types of variances. We refer to one as the dirty water variance, where the jurisdiction cannot meet the requirements, and the clean water variance, where the source water is so good that it is not necessary to further treat. Oregon, when it wrote its statutes, arranged for the first, the dirty water variance. It didn't for the second. It is our interest to have that second variance available as an option. As you may know, the City of Portland is challenging the LT2 rule that would require the City of Portland to treat its water further. If we don't prevail in that, we would like the option of being able to seek the variance. Right now, that is not an option because of the way the statute's written.
Okay, thank you. Representative, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. committee members. For the record, Ben Cannon, State Representative of District 46 in Portland. There are a few things that I brag to out-of-towners about Portland. One of them is that we have the largest urban park in the country with cougars and barn owls and other large wildlife. Two is that we provide coffee and snacks to cyclists as they cross on the bridges on their way downtown once a month just on a volunteer basis. And third is that we have some of the purest, best-tasting municipal water in the country. You've heard about the clean water variance, why this is so important, that the potentially costly and burdensome compliance requirements that we may incur under LT2 and we'd be more likely to incur if this bill doesn't pass. It's especially important to my district that we pass this variance because it contains one of the most important nodes in the city water system, that is the Mount Tabor reservoirs. My constituents in District 46 would hate to see the purity of wonderful, precious Bull Run water diminished by unnecessary treatment. We would hate to see the loss of the architectural heritage of the Mount Tabor reservoirs due to potential capping, and we would hate to see this bill fail to pass. Encourage your I vote.
Very good. Committee, any questions for either?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume you don't want that water polluted by fluoride either.
Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing on thank you, Senator Bates. House Bill 3469. Open up our work session on House Bill 3469. If I could have a motion.
Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 3469 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator. Moving House Bill 3469 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, and I'll carry that one, Sue. With that, I'll close the work session on 3469, and I'm going to open a public hearing on 2723A. Matt, if you could, I see Tom back there right now. Is the representative on his way, or are you here for him today? Okay. While we're waiting for Representative Greenlick, Chris Crean, you're the only other one signed up. Why don't you come on up, and we'll let you get started.
Three different amendments, and I don't know. Which one do you want?
Yeah, side two.
Let me figure out which one to do.
Would you like me to give a little summary?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2723A establishes a process by which a county or city may validate and an owner may record an established unit of land if the unit was unlawfully created by a previous owner on or before January 1st, 2007. This received a public hearing already, and there was a work group established under the leadership of Senator Beyer, which developed three possible amendments. One, the Dash A6 amendment was at the request of the county recorders. This language requires, prior to the recording of a fee title, that a reference to the recording number of an approved final subdivision plat or partition plat or a statement signed by the authorized county or city planning department that the division is lawfully created unit and then the Dash 7 and the Dash 8 retains that language. The Dash 7 also adds a revision of the owner disclosure statement question on page 7 related to an unlawfully established unit of land so that a yes response triggers the need for additional information. And the Dash 8 retains the recorder's language and removes the owner disclosure question on page 7 related to an unlawfully established unit of land. The work group agreed on the recorder's language of the Dash 6, but did not come to a full agreement on the Dash 7 or the Dash 8 and left it to the committee.
Matt, I notice a lot of people signing up over there for something, and I am betting it's this bill. So why don't you, when you can, grab that and bring it up.
Mr. Chair, if you like my perspective while we're waiting.
I actually was just going to ask you to do that, so why don't you do that? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you just heard, the Dash, what the three different amendments do, it was my decision after about an hour in the work group that there would never be an agreement in the work group on the the issue dealing on page 7, the seller's disclosure statement. So that's why I asked to have the three different amendments drafted and let the committee decide how they wanted to go on it. My perspective is this, Mr. Chair, that the seller disclosure statement is unneeded because in most real estate transactions, the first thing you're going to do is see what is in Section 7 on the bill, which is the disclosure that goes with the offer to buy. It's only after you have a confirmed offer to purchase that you get to the seller's disclosure statement. And there's already being inserted that everyone agrees with a piece, as you see in Section 7 of the bill, that says that the unit of land being transferred is a lawful established, or you are asked to verify that it is. So that the buyer is receiving a document that says they should go out and verify that this is a lawfully created unit of land before they ever get to this seller's disclosure statement, which is dealing with in Section 8 of the bill. So my first choice would be to take that seller's disclosure statement out and insert the change the county clerks needed. The second choice, my...
That'd be A6?
That would be the A... Eight amendments.
Eight, okay.
Okay. My second choice would be to do the A7 amendments, which leaves a seller's disclosure in the bill, but it reverses the language in it so that the no becomes the preferred check, so you do not have to attach documentation if it is a legally created. You only have to attach documentation if you don't think it is, which... Again, I think both cases, if you leave it in, you're going to get an unknown likely to be checked on both of those. That's why I don't think the seller disclosure statement really does you any good, because it's mostly, most often going to be checked unknown, and the buyer already has received notice that they should go out and check and make sure it is. So that's why my preferred would be the A8s, but...
So do the A8s include the A6s, or would we need to dock? They do?
Yes, the A's, okay. The A8s.
All right.
Include the A6s. So,
all right, good.
That is my perspective after hearing, you know, both sides of the issue and the testimony we heard earlier. But Representative Greenlicko, I think, is on the way over. I talked with his staff person was at the work group meeting and he indicated that. That Representative Greenleaf would probably prefer the A6 amendments, but could live with any of the three.
Senator Bates.
Just so I can be certain of this, Senator Byers, I understand it. The A7s relate to the part of the bill on page 7, line 28, is the property being transferred to a lawfully established unit of land, yes, no, or unknown, and that triggers a question by the buyer, but you referred Section 7, which language has been added, that unit of land being transferred to a lawfully established lot or parcel as defined in ORS, whatever, to verify the previous lot parcel. It appears to me, reading that section warns the potential buyer that it's their responsibility to go check this out. Is that the way I'm reading that?
Mr. Chair, yes. That's Section 7, which is the first document that is normally received by a purchaser of real estate in a transaction with a real estate agent. That is in Section 7. Everyone agrees, keep that in. That warns the buyer that to check. And then the other one is the next documentation, and that's the one that is the disagreement among the work group, whether to take that out, leave it in, or reword it.
And by the next one, you just mean the next section?
The next section, yes.
Section 8?
Section 8 on page 7 is the disagreement area, lines 28 and 29.
All right. And so the dash 8 take out only that line 28 and 29?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not the entire Section 8?
Well, they delete the entire Section 8 because there's no other changes.
Because there would be nothing else needed.
Right. There are no changes in Section 8 to take that out.
Since we're waiting, a follow-up question. Was there a discussion in the work group about the responsibility of a real estate agent to, when they're representing the client who's buying, to be certain that they're looking at a parcel that has been legally parceled? I mean, it would seem that the real estate agent has some responsibility here to follow the law and say, yes, I've checked this out. Not only have we got good title, which really title check is primarily liens and second and third mortgages and things of that nature, but isn't necessarily designed to look at whether a parcel has been lawfully lawfully subdivided or divided. So was there a discussion about the realtor's role in this?
Mr. Chair, yes, there was. And, in fact, that's in a different part of the bill. And thank you for my – I was hoping – I don't know if you, if everyone else has got this memo. But in the bill, there is a section, and I can't even tell you exactly where it is to point to it in the bill, but where under current law, the well, under this bill, the real estate agent, if they are representing a seller and they are misrepresenting it, they will be subject not only to damages but also to pay the buyer's attorney's fees. So the real estate agent who's representing the seller of the parcel would be on the hook if they are misrepresenting the parcel as being legally a legal lot. Hope that answered your question.
Yes, and I believe I see also in the bill, Mr. Chair, if I might, since we're still waiting, that this establishes a legal right for the buyer if they find out after purchase of the land that they have a standing in court to recover damages from the seller.
Yes.
So there's quite a few changes here from current law. This is some big changes.
This is a very good bill, there's a lot more to this bill than I realized when we left the first hearing. And it does a lot to protect buyers of property.
In my particular county, I would say, Mr. Chair, that this kind of a law would have solved a lot of problems before it happened. This is a very common occurrence in Jackson County, and parcels have been subdivided, frankly, illegally. And the buyer wasn't aware of it until after purchase, and often years after the purchase when they go to do something to the land, and then they find out that they're not even supposed to be there. So it's been some tough stuff. Looks like a pretty good bill right now.
Let's do this. He is here. I was just going to say Representative Greenlink is delayed, so we will just keep moving. I wish that the representative could have heard that discussion we just had. But, Representative, do you want to say some things, or do you just want to listen to where we're going? Okay, you want to say some things. Come on up.
Mitch Greenlink.
You know me.
Yeah, I know. I was.
You lost your head there for a minute.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm members of the committee.
I'm a lot of breath, not because of the running.
You have two sets of amendments before you, the 6 and the 7 amendments. In case I didn't make clear the last time I was here, I'm comfortable with either of the 6 or the 7 amendments. I think we do need the language that the clerks need. But I really hope we'll put on the 6 or the 7 amendments and roll with the bill.
There is also a dash 8. You want to go over that again, Senator?
I've seen that one.
The dash 8 removes the seller's disclosure completely.
I'm comfortable with that one, too.
All right. Good enough, then. Anything else?
Nope.
All right. We have a long list of folks, actually, that want to testify on the bill. So if you have time to sit and listen,
I'll sit for a little while.
That would be great.
I'm chairing a committee down the hall at the same time. I will be.
Then
I've got a couple of nice freshmen running the committee. It's working better than it is with me.
I heard some hooping and hollering down there. I didn't know what it was.
I think it's a coup.
Facilitate the coup. I'm going to call folks up a few at a time. Please, with your testimony, keep this in mind. We are hearing the Bear-Cougar bill right after this. Long list of people to testify there. And you've heard this discussion by the committee on the various amendments. The bill will be moving today with an amendment or a combination of amendments. So if your testimony could go to which of those amendments suits you best, that might be the most helpful testimony for the committee. Director Shetterly, Ron Eber, and Art Schlack. Oh,
Welcome, Mr. Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, good to be back. Lane Shatterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Mr. Chair, I heard some of the conversation about this, and what I would say, there is a strong component of consumer protection in this bill, obviously. And I think Senator Bates touched on the problem that we've had over the history of the past decades of lots being created illegally, only to have that discovered by a remote purchaser of one of those illegally created lots who finds themselves limited in terms of their ability to develop or use their land how they intended, and really without any remedy because the wrongdoer is so far removed in title and may even be out of the county and out of the country and long gone. That's a bad situation. So this bill really addresses that in two parts. One is looking backwards and one is looking forward. In the backward-looking part, it creates a process for, I don't want to say amnesty, we'll say validation of these parcels that exist out there across the landscape today. Going forward, there are two components. One is the notice to the buyer, and that is accomplished in two ways in the bill currently, and that is through the addition to the statutory notice that goes on earnest money agreements and on deeds. That's that boilerplate language that appears in all capital letters. But the other is the express reference to the legal status of the lot or parcel that would be called out in the seller's disclosure statement. I think our sense, because we get calls on a lot of these, is that the more you can do to put prospective purchasers of the property on notice, the stronger this bill is going to be. Sad to say, people often don't read all the boilerplate that appears in the statutory notice and the earnest money agreements and the deeds. It's there. It has its purpose. If you couple that, as it occurs in the sixes and sevens, with an express call out of that issue in the disclosure statement, I think there is value in that. I don't think it calls requires anyone to make a legal determination. If someone doesn't know, they check unknown, and that puts the buyer on notice to make inquiry. If they do know, yes, they can check yes. If they know it's not, they'd better check no. But either way, it's going to have the salutary purpose of raising this as an issue for a buyer to be aware of. And if the answer in the disclosure statement is unknown, then that really puts the buyer on inquiry notice to discover for themselves. And so in terms of what we see coming to us from disappointed buyers of property who find themselves having purchased lots that they cannot use or build upon, the more we can do to strengthen notice, I think the stronger this bill will be. And so because of that, we would support either of the amendments that maintain both the statutory disclosure statement, I'm sorry, the statutory notice statement in earnest money agreements and conveyancing documents, as well as the disclosure statement.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I've got nothing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2723 represents the best opportunity we've had in years to address a very serious problem in the land use planning and also the whole land use arena in the state of Oregon, and that is the establishment of illegal lots, or shall we say unlawful lots at this point. We at the county level deal with this a lot, and it takes a tremendous amount of time and effort. This is a 2723 represents a comprehensive opportunity to not only provide the phrase was amnesty, but the ability to recognize lots that may have been not lawfully created but could have been if the person who sold those lots had gone through a partition subdivision process and done those in a manner. And I commend that process to you at this point to recognize those as it may be on a case-by-case basis as they're brought in by a new purchaser and do a one-lot partition. That will, I think, really help the land use planning process in the state of Oregon. The other thing that is essential is we need to address going forward, and I think this bill does that. This has been a product of a lot of people, and not only planners, but I think realtors and others will have to do business just a little bit different to wind up at the end of the day with a much better product and an opportunity that the citizens who buy property will do those knowing that they have a lawfully created parcel and will be able to do what they want to do. We've already heard this session, Mr. Chair, people coming into this into the Capitol asking for relief for the for these very things. And so I commend this bill to you and the work of Representative Greenlick and the others that have worked so hard on this bill.
Thank you. Any preference between the Dash 7s and Dash 8s if you've had a chance to look at them?
I have had. Either one will work for us.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Eber?
I would just say I think the Dash 6s and the Dash 7s are the amendments the department supports. It keeps the disclosure statement in there in one form or another. And I think Mr. Schlack is correct. This is a sea change. Everyone's going to have to do business a little bit differently, the planners, the clerks, the realtors, and this gets us to a point where we don't end up with folks like you heard from previously who are caught in what I like to refer to as the black hole of planning. They have a unit of land, but it's not lawful. And there was just a Court of Appeals decision that came out yesterday that describes one of these cases. You've got two owners, and they can't go forward, and they can't go back unless one agrees to sell to the other. And they're stuck, and we need a way to address those issues.
Good. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris Crean, Harlan Levy, Craig Chisholm. Did you two want to come up together? Why don't you guys wait then? I'll bring you both up next. And Dan Eisenbeiss, why don't you come on up? Mr. Levy, why don't you go ahead and go first?
Thank you, Chair Vaki and members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. First of all, I want to thank Senator Beyer for working with us in the work group on this bill. You do have three sets of amendments in front of you. Our preferred amendment is the -A8, which, as you heard, will remove the seller's property disclosure statement. I went over that in my previous testimony. I don't want to be too redundant, but I do want to remind the committee that if that language remains in the seller's property disclosure statement, you will be asking a layperson a legal conclusion, and we would prefer that that not be the case. It sets up the seller for a lot of potential problems, so we would ask that that be removed. There is plenty of other notice to the buyer in other sections of the bill. In addition to that, I've distributed a memo to you that I gave out at the work group. There was some questions during the last hearing regarding realtors that might be involved in the situation. I want to adamantly state for the record that a real estate licensee who knowingly assists a client in selling an illegally created lot without full disclosure to a buyer will be held liable both by the real estate agency and as well in a civil action. So there is plenty of potential liability out there for my members that might be engaged in practices that we would obviously not then want to be engaged in. That being said, again, we do support the -A8 amendments. There was another issue that did arise after the work group. I did want to put the committee on notice of that. You'll hear about that from the witnesses that are coming behind us, and that's the issue that the title insurance companies have raised. They are concerned that this Section 3, whether it be the Section 3 in the existing bill or the Section 3 that is being rewritten in these amendments, might create problems in the real property conveyance system, might make it more difficult, more time-consuming, and hinder closings. And we are a bit concerned about that, but I'll leave that up to them to elaborate on those issues with the committee. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Crane. I'm a land use attorney practicing in Portland. My I've been practicing for over 12 years. My experience also includes 6 years with legislative counsel, about 2.5 years representing private developers with Miller Nash, and 3 years with Multnomah County. So my experience reflects, I think, a fairly unusual cross-section of the development interests in the state, including private developers, local governments, and the legislature. I would concur with Mr. Schlack's comments. This bill is way too long in coming. My first session was 1995, and in that session I drafted probably a half dozen bills for members trying to fix this problem for individual constituents, and that happened every session I was with legislative counsel. With Multnomah County, two or three times a month, these folks would come to our planning department, and the planners would have to tell them, I'm sorry, I know what you paid for the property. I can see it on the deed, but we can't issue any permits for you to build on that property, at which point the property owner wanted to come over the counter and continue the discussion in another fashion, shall we say. Just yesterday, Mr. Eber mentioned the Stevens versus Theurer case. A woman in 1982 had a 29-acre parcel. She deeded 7 acres to a daughter and son-in-law, and then 2 years later deeded the remaining 22 acres to two grandchildren, two other people, and then she dies in 1991. The daughter and son-in-law in 1997 or 98 sold their property to somebody else. None of this was done with the county's approval. And as the court said, as a result, none of the parties can build on their lots or sell them. You've got 29 acres of undeveloped property in Benton County. It's now tied up. This opinion came out yesterday. It's a very real problem. It's got to be solved. Section 2 does that for most of the properties out there. It gives the property owner opportunity to come in and apply to have their property validated. That's the retroactive portion. Your colleague in the House were very adamant that we fix this problem going forward as well. We've
Mr.
got
Crane,
to stop.
Yes. Have you seen the -7s and -8s?
And the -6s, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you give us your opinion on that? Because the committee, I appreciate your opinions very much, but the committee is well settled on the rest of the provisions.
Thank you,
of the
Mr.
bill.
Chair. I believe the -6s or the -7s are the most advisable amendments. I personally don't put a lot of stock in either of the disclosure statements. The disclosure statement in Section 7 is presented to the purchaser at closing in the middle of probably a 2-inch stack of documents, all of which you're signing and initialing. It's way too late for that notice to be of any use to anyone. I don't put a whole lot of stock in that. I do think that it's useful. The seller's disclosure statement in the subsequent section, so that is the subject of the -8s, is presented to the seller earlier in the process, and at least raises the flag. As Mr. Shetterly said, it will have a salutary effect, I believe, on the buyers and sellers. I think what you're going to hear from the title companies is a lot of discussion about Section 3, the going forward section. And I'll just close with this comment. With all of the statutes I drafted, thousands of statutes, probably tens of thousands of amendments, the take-home lesson for me is there's no such thing as a perfect law or a perfect statute or a perfect bill. We may well be back in a couple of years tweaking this bill, or maybe next year. I've lost track of that process. But this bill is important. It's an arcane, dark corner of land use law, and it's hard. It's hard to fix, and we have done what I think is an admirable effort. It may not be perfect, and we may be back, but we've got to fix this problem going forward to prevent these problems from happening in the future.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to just help clear up the record a little bit, too. Art Schlack sent me up a note just saying that the counties support the -6s or -7s, not the -8s, in case you're keeping notes. I think he mistakenly said -8s when he was up here. So it's 6 or 7s for the counties. Thank you, Mr. Eisenbeis.
Chair Vaki and members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeis with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'll keep my remarks very brief, but say that this is a very important bill in the comprehensive nature, both addressing past created illegal lots and preventing the creation of illegal lots in the future is what makes this bill work. I'd like to thank Senator Beyer for leading the work group. We support the A6 or the A7 amendments. We would oppose the A8 amendments. As Mr. Crane pointed out, having the statement in the seller's representation list is an important flag for the purchaser of the property and one that's not adequately covered by the seller's disclosure statement. I'd also point out for the committee that it is consistent with already established practice for other provisions of real estate transactions. If you look at the new statements I and G on page 7, that call out whether there's any zoning violations, non-conforming uses, zoning overlays. That is essentially also called out in the seller's disclosure statement in lines 37 to 41 on page 4. So it is not unusual to raise issues in both places. And I would also say that Section 3 is absolutely critical for this bill moving forward. If we do not have a mechanism in place to assure that these lots will not be created in the future, then this bill falls short. Thank
okay,
you.
Good. Thank you very much. The three of you appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chair, can I correct one thing in the record, please?
Sure.
I just wanted to point out that in Section 7, the portion of the language that goes in the earnest money agreements usually is the first thing that the buyer sees. And the reason for that is it is contained in the form that most real estate agents use to make the offer. It's an earnest money agreement form. So that is the first thing that they see, whereas the seller's property disclosure statement they see only after the offer has been accepted.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And now, Craig Chisholm and Cleve Abbey. Very good of both of you to come down and testify today. We're going to have to move fairly quickly since we have a hefty bill coming next. But please go right ahead.
Thank you, Senator. I'm Cleve Abbey here on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association, a trade association of title companies. The title companies certainly have no objection to the remedies for buyers that this bill attempts to create and to try to improve the disclosures and ability for buyers to have an idea of what they're buying. We are very concerned about Section 3. And the reason is that, in our view, and there, it puts properties into two categories. One is those that correspond to a recorded plat of subdivision or partition. And then the other category is everything else. There's a lot of section land, that is property that's not the subject of a subdivision plat or partition plat. The rural counties, Jackson County, have lots of land like that. And by our reading of the bill, anything that is not in a subdivision plat or partition plat will have to have this certification from the planning department that it corresponds with a, what's called a legal lot. And parties who have transactions with that kind of land won't be able to record their deed until that certification comes in. And we're concerned that those statements, certifications, won't be available in a timely manner. I took a quick look this morning at kind of the volume of deed transactions in the Portland Tri-County area. It's my feeling that they're probably in the neighborhood of 20 or 30% of transactions where you're dealing with a lot plus a portion of another lot or with section land. And that would probably work out to about, by my rough calculation under this bill, you probably need about 150 property transactions a week that would need this kind of review just in the city of Portland, or in the, excuse me, in the, that would be in roughly in the city of Portland. And we're not sure that the planning departments can keep up with that kind of volume, because the way we read the bill, those transactions won't be able to close until this certification is forthcoming. If the certification is that it's not a legal lot, the transaction won't go forward at all. What we're concerned about is the transactions, the normal ones that everybody would want to go forward.
Very good. Senator Pozanski?
What's the remedy? If we take out Section 3, that's what I'm hearing, how do we actually give that assurance that when someone is actually buying what they think is a legal lot and a real property that they can actually have equity in and investment and make changes to it, sell it, whatever. How do we accomplish that?
I think the best answer is to improve the sanctions and remedies of buyers in those situations. And I think the other parts of the bill go a long way in that direction. They amplify the issue of sellers having to make disclosure about the status of the land in this regard. So those efforts, I think, are well-founded, and we certainly support.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, then would you also approve or agree that a realtor in that case would have an affirmative duty to do some type of due diligence to determine what they're representing up or sell for their client, and they should also be on the hook for that, not just on the knowledge of fraudulent activity?
Well, I think all I can leave this at is that, you know, we support the remedies and the disclosure, and that could be a component of it. I can't really speak on behalf of the realtors and some of the other professionals that this might affect. It could affect lawyers representing buyers and sellers.
That's right.
But I can't really address that.
Senator Przanski, sort of in answer.
Why don't you go ahead and say your name for the record?
No, pardon me. Craig Chisholm with Oregon Land Title Association. I know time is short, but I think consideration should be given, and obviously we don't have time enough to do it, to having another place than deed records, which are records of priority rights. Really, the information about land use and land use rights would be going into the wrong place. There needs to be another place, and it needs to be controlled by the government, needs to be accessible, needs to be tied into a geographic indexing system, and it can be a place where you can put a multitude of issues that keep occurring in this legislature where people are trying to get information about property but it's non-title. You have lead paint, you have hazardous waste sites, on and on. I've been down here 20 years and the problem keeps cropping up. This is a very good thing that Chris Crane and so on are trying to approach this problem. It is clearly a problem. I guess what I would say, and I only have a few seconds, is don't solve it in the title records. And the title records are the wrong place to put the information.
Any other questions? All right. I guess I do appreciate the both of you being here very much. It's, you're right. It's late in the game for amendments, and since the committees are going to be closing down next week. But I think you raise a point that is valid. And this committee, I think, would very much appreciate, after this bill is enacted, that we get some information within the next couple of years on what the effect has been. And if there are changes that we need to make at that point, I think that your testimony would be very welcomed again.
Sure.
Senator Beyer.
Well, kind of on that note, I guess, this bill does not have an emergency clause, so it will not go into effect until January 1st of 08. And I think if we do, in fact, have a special session in February, which is may or may not happen, but if it does happen, it seems to me that there are issues being raised here that probably weren't raised until now, and we have two options as a committee. We could send this bill to rules and let them try to scramble with something for the next week or so, or we can fix it. We can pass the bill now. An interim committee can work with these groups on this issue between now and January 1st, and if, in fact, we do come up with a better remedy, a bill could be passed in the February session. You would have a two-month gap that this law would apply to, because you could fix it in February with an emergency clause to make it go into effect immediately, and you could thoughtfully look at the situation for the next 6 months and try to come up with a better remedy.
Well, the second option is certainly one I would favor.
Well, I would too, actually.
All right, good. Thank you both very much for being here. I appreciate your testimony. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2723. I'm going to open up a work session on 2723. Before we have a motion, we've got, of course, the dash sixes, sevens, and eights. We know the sixes are coming in under one, either the sevens or the eights. They're included in the sevens too, right?
Yes.
All right, so the debate is between the sevens and the eights. My preference, and by a box score of 4-1, the preference of the folks who testified would be the dash sevens. But why don't we come to that conclusion before we move to a motion? Senator Bates?
I prefer the dash sevens.
Senator Przanski?
I can live with the sevens. I think that, based on what we've heard.
Senator Beyer, you okay with that?
Mr. Chair, the will of the committee works for me.
All right, good enough. Could I have a motion then?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A7s into House Bill 2723.
Senator Przanski moves the dash 7s into House Bill 2723. Any discussion? Any objections?
Seeing none, the dash sevens are adopted, and a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Pruszanski moves House Bill 2723 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm definitely going to support it. I do want to put on the record, I did make some statement that was pointed toward the realtors, and it's not to single out the realtors alone. I just think people that are acting as professionals, being an attorney or whoever that represents, needs to have more due diligence. They're getting paid for their services, and I just think that that's something that we should realize, that individuals that are in this process that are lay people, they rely on whoever those experts are, be it an attorney, be it a realtor, be it whoever, or whatever other topics. And to me, it seems to me that there's a need for that. I do believe what we have here at least will give a little bit more of an opportunity for people to question. And I clearly appreciate Mr. Harlan's, Mr. Levy's position as to what's in there as it pertains to fraudulent activities. It goes for everyone that's licensed. Again, the same thing that would hit the attorneys as well as realtors, and that's one area of it. It just seems to me that one of the other things is that if everyone that's in this chain had a little bit more, let's say, responsibility for their portion of it, it may help us to clean up this activity and make sure that everyone's is selling what they think they're selling, everyone's buying what they think they're buying, and everyone would be a little bit more protected.
Very good. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Beyer, would you carry this one?
Yes, I can.
All right, thank you. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2723. And we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2971A. Sue, if you could give us a quick rundown on the bill, then I'm going to make a few comments, then we'll get into the substance.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2971A allows the Department of Fish and Wildlife to appoint person to act as agent for the purpose of using one or more dogs to hunt or pursue black bear or cougar, requires the hunt or pursuit to be in compliance with the black bear management plan and the cougar management plan adopted by rule by the department, Fish and Wildlife Commission, prohibits agent from engaging in any other hunting or pursuit while acting on behalf of the department, and directs the department to make the appointment in a written form to fix compensation, prescribe duties of agent, and adopt by rule a process and criteria for selecting agents.
And also we have, do you want to do the amendment too? Or you want me to do that?
I can
do that. Also, we have a dash 3-A3 amendment, which generally does two things. One of them is it lists, it directs the agency to institute rules that deal with the qualifications and training of agents that they may appoint, and then gives some specific suggestions, such as policies regarding the use of firearms and first aid and using snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles, and then also allows the use of taking fingerprints in order to do criminal history checks on anybody that may be an agent, and then also provides a six-year sunset on the bill. The reason for the sunset is because I think it would be very helpful to this legislative body to have some of the statistical evidence regarding not only the population of cougars in certain parts of the state, but also the claimed depletion on elk and deer herds. And that period of time will allow the agency to undergo some good statistical analysis. So that's what the amendments are. Now, with respect to how we're going to do this, we have about 32 minutes before the session. The Senate is going to be called into session. There are much too many people that are signed up to testify for us to get everybody on the record. It just will be physically impossible to do. So if you are here with a group, for instance, there is a panel of Sally Mackler, Ivan Molesky, and Noah Greenwald. If you can do it, I would appreciate you picking one person that will come up on that panel in order to express the opinions of the panel. If you can't, I'm not going to preclude you. And then I will try and get through folks, but I'm just giving fair warning, we will not be able to get through everybody, and we will resolve the bill one way or another before we go into session at 4:30. The other parameter I want to mention before we start taking testimony is that this bill is not about whether or not the state will have a cougar or a bear management plan. That is already in law. It is also not about whether the state has the authority to appoint agents. They actually, under existing law, have got authority to do some things like that. And so I want to make, and it's also not about Measure 18, so I just want to make sure that whatever your testimony is, that it doesn't fall into those already very well settled areas. Representative Roblin, I see you here. Would you like to come up? I also will make sure that folks who traveled from large distances will get a chance to testify first. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair Avakian. For the record, my name is Arne Roblin. I am State Representative from District 9 in Coos Bay. And I appreciate the words you said just a few moments ago, because really why I'm here is that this is a bill about giving the state the tools they need to manage the wildlife that we have here in the state. And that's really all it's about. It is about having the tools to manage. And as you mentioned, we did have a ballot measure which stopped the hunting of cougars with dogs. And when that happened, this was the way we managed the cougar and bear population. We had agents, and then there was a ruling by the Attorney General that said we can't do agents that way. So this is basically letting us get back to that place where we have the options available to the professionals in the department to manage the plan that has gone through the process that our plans go through in different agencies. Those of us who live in rural areas have recognized that wildlife continues to come and visit more and more to our rural communities. In our town, a number of sightings have happened with cougar. In our middle school, we have a large marsh area, and there have been a number of reports of cougar in that marsh area, right next to where the kids are going to school. And I had one friend who's a doctor who lives just outside of town, and in the last year, he has actually had the opportunity to shoot at cougar, bear, and coyote from his front porch, basically, because we have, I believe, and I agree with the department, a larger and larger population of animals that are moving out of their territory and coming into what was normally where we were living. And the chance for members of our community to be hurt by these animals grows every day. And I believe that if we don't give the tools to the agency to do their job, which is to help protect citizens, we are not doing our job here at the legislature. So with that, I would entertain any questions you might have.
Okay. I don't see any. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Ron Englund and Dwayne Jackson, I'm going to bring you up just because this affects your agency directly, of course. If you could keep your testimony relatively brief, I would appreciate that. Also, I noticed that you checked the box neutral, which surprised me. So why don't you explain that, too?
Chair Avakian, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. With me today is Dwayne Jackson, one of our principal researchers from Southwest Oregon. Won't go into our testimony. It does address the original bill as amended. It does not address the amendments that you read into the record today. We are supportive of those amendments. We typically don't take stands on bills one way or another as we're making our testimony, which is why I checked the neutral box. With your permission, Mr. Chair, there's been a couple of questions come up relative to damage complaints and verifications of those, conflict with livestock, what does that mean, and relative to the population model. If you'd like for me for us to touch on that real quickly, we could do that.
Does anybody on the committee need him to get into that? Let's just move on then.
Okay. With that, Mr. Chair, we are supportive of the amendment that you read into the record, and be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Jackson, anything to add?
No, sir.
Questions? Senator Pozanski.
Can you give us just a very short summary on the verification of how that is done? I'll have that on the record. I know a lot of people have raised that issue.
Chair Vaki and Senator Pozanski, verification can occur in a couple of different ways. If we get a specific complaint where there is a dead animal, typically our staff, Wildlife Services, or a county agent will go out and inspect that to try and verify whether it was caused by a cougar, dogs, accident, and it was scavenged, something like that. So you have an actual on-the-ground verification by a department employee or somebody that works with those, works with damage. Unverified complaints typically are ones that either we receive on the phone, based on the information that we've received, feel that, yeah, there potentially was a cougar there, it could have caused a problem, but we don't mark it down as verified. Or if we go out on site to inspect a damage complaint and we cannot tell for certain that it was caused by a cougar or some other creature.
Just clarification. So if someone calls in and says, I believe a cougar, or they say a cougar was there, and then your department hears that information, if you're not able to actually go out and substantiate it on the ground in the field, then it just goes down as unverified and does not go toward the verified count?
Senator Avakian, or Chair Avakian, Senator Pozanski, that's correct. If we can't physically go out and verify it, we do not mark it as verified on our damage complaint forms. And likewise, if somebody calls and says that I saw a cougar on my property, we do not mark that down as a complaint. We mark that down as a sighting.
Last question, mm-hmm. on the follow-up. As for, regarding the unverified, what impact does it have on you or your department as to setting up the management plan and implementing it?
Chair Vaki and Senator Pozanski, the unverified complaints obviously go into the database. We look at that in conjunction with verified complaints, which are animals where we have determined that a cougar was there. All of those fall down in a lower category within the cougar plan that is driven primarily through animals that have been killed on verified damage. So the first level of complaint that we look at is one where there's a verification and we have taken an animal on that damage complaint. If we do that, and then we can make a determination on whether we need to take other action within the cougar management plan, then we look at the other data relative to complaints themselves and where do those occur in relation to where we've had these verified damage complaints. And in looking at that, as we develop the cougar management plan, they overlay exactly with, in the past, all of our verified damage complaints, all of our verification on where we have taken animals off of damage.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Senator Bates.
Oh, thank you. Just a couple of quick questions. I know our time is short. When you have a verified damage, I would assume you cannot track that to a specific cougar. I mean, you can see the damage done probably by a cougar, but you can't track that back to a specific cougar. So your management, I assume, is to remove a cougar from the area or more than one cougar to reduce the population. Is that what your attempt is in management?
Chair Avaki and Senator Bates, it depends. If we have a verified damage complaint, within the plan and within law, we or the landowner is allowed to take out the offending animal that has caused that damage. And what we have discovered is if we can get there soon enough and it is in a location where dogs can be used, you can catch that individual animal fairly easily if the conditions are right to track it with the dog. If dogs are not suitable for that location, we have had success in working with Wildlife Services and with county agents in the past in setting traps at that kill site and being able to catch the animal when it comes back to feed.
I'll ask other questions off the record. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both very much. Lynn Sadler, Stephanie Tidwell, Catherine Keene. Go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Lynn Sadler. I'm the National Director of the Mountain Lion Foundation. We're a 20-year-old nonprofit dedicated to saving America's lion. Our perspective is national. We work in the 14 states that have not yet driven the cougar to extinction. I became interested in this because the IUCN, which is the international association that's responsible for monitoring the world species, has stated that the cougar is threatened and perhaps vulnerable to extinction because of, number one, persecution, and number two, habitat loss. And we're seeing some signs of pressure here in Oregon toward that. Cougars make their living staying out of sight. There's studies going on right now that show they will expend considerable effort to stay away from humans. And when they can't do that, that indicates to us that we need to investigate whether or not that's a cougar population under considerable pressure. We are interested in HB 2971 because it specifically addresses methods of persecution. The one thing that I would say that I think is the second you said this isn't about Measure 18. From our point of view, it is about Measure 18 because it is inconsistent with Measure 18. You're going to hear about that from other people. In our mind, the second worst flaw in AB 2971 is that it will not accomplish the goal of reduced conflict. This particular plan calls for the random shooting of lions, whether or not they've been involved in a conflict, so it's not going to make anyone or anyone safer. We have a very... we have the advantage of a 32-year long controlled study, real life, real time, of the effectiveness of the random removal of cougars. California has had no trophy hunting of lions since 1972, only the selective removal. So on a per capita or per habitat acre basis, California, there's many states that have trophy hunting and have higher attack rates on people and livestock. So we have found that trophy hunting does not make people safer. In fact, the one area with the highest level of trophy hunting actually has the highest level of attacks on people. So our concern is that this giving this particular tool to the state is not going to accomplish the purpose for anyone, and it's therefore inappropriate. But to us, the worst flaw...
And I'll need you to go ahead and get to your...
Sure. The worst flaw in this bill is it's pulling us off the point. Right now, there is no state in the union that can demonstrate it is managing for sustainability, and Oregon has no conservation plan. We are fighting over how to kill cougars when we don't know how to conserve them. We are trying to alter how many we have when we don't know how many we need. You have the advantage here in Oregon of a study that was done by Oregon State University. I've brought copies of that slide that show diversity suffers when cougars are rare. Okay, how many is rare? We need to figure that out before we just try to alter how many there are. We need to get off of this default of lethal retaliation and get on to how can we change our behavior in order to conserve cougars, and how can we get creative by getting away from this knee-jerk lethal response. How can we get creative and figure out, get the innovation we need to conserve them and the landscape we know and love? Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Would you like to get copies of this study?
If you've got them, turn them into Matt.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Either one of you, please. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chairman and members. I'll try and be expeditious. My name is Catherine Kane, and I'm a retired school teacher, and public safety is my primary concern, especially the safety of children. And I've submitted to you a written copy, if the nice man will pass it around, of 10 reasons why there the scientific facts why you should vote against this bill. The first one is that it is the cougar population is biologically self-limiting. In other words, the habitat and the prey days determine the number of predators. And when you kill a resident cat, what happens is they're replaced by transients. And researchers have shown that transients are the most dangerous type of cat. They don't know how to hunt yet. They're in a vacuum that has been created by the killing of the older cats. So they can't catch deer, and they eat your dog or the goat you left on the rope. Ungulate declines, contrary to apparently rumors around here, are not being caused by mountain lions. Yes, they do eat elk and deer, but it's the vast system of roadways and access and the amount of overhunting and the direct habitat decline that the ODFW, I have one of their little cute flyer magazines from like 15 years ago showing about the drastic decline in elk, and that's when cats were back being hunted. So there's no research that's ever proven here that cats are having any substantial impact on elk, quite the reverse. And please don't make the mistake of thinking that it's a housekeeping bill. This is obviously just the second part of their second step to implement their plan, because they can't kill enough cougars, apparently. And this is just this session's version of the blatant terror campaign that ODFW has been trying to promulgate. There really is no problem. Measure 18 has safety checks within it, and it's doing a very good job as far as we're concerned. Measure 18 is a flaming success. There have been no problems other than livestock damage. So I hope that that is addressed by better husbandry. But anyhow, the ODFW has used faulty data. Monte Carlo is just gambling. Conceptual premise of their whole plan is wrong. What we really need, if you are concerned about wildlife, are large refugia. That is, no access, leave the elk alone, and the state should promulgate that. But one of the most important things here is that these same hunters that you are going to be unleashing are the ones who we have had trials at because of the international black market in bear galls. I attend these trials and I speak for the animals. There were big rings out of several towns right in the Willamette Valley that were wiping out whole areas of cougars. So the guys you're unleashing are not a nice bunch of fellows, and you can ask the OSP if you want. We don't have money for going and chasing them. The CITES II treaty...
I'll need you to go ahead and wrap up, too. We've got a lot more people.
Sure. The CITES II isn't a significant treaty because bears are endangered worldwide. Gallbladders go for $500 each. They're selling them in Corvallis and Portland. You don't want to open up the woods for that. Mm-hmm. And please, the last thing is the state risks lawsuits from the public if anybody is harmed by this policy, because we haven't had any problems. If somebody is attacked, you may indeed have some liability here. So please don't pass this bill. Thank you.
My name is Stephanie Tidwell, and I'm the Executive Director of the Klamasiski Wildland Center, a conservation organization that works to protect public lands and wildlife in Southwest Oregon. On behalf of our 1,500-plus members, I'm here today to express our opposition to House Bill 2971. As a science-based conservation organization, KSWL concurs with the analysis you are about to hear from the Center for Biological Diversity staff biologist Noah Greenwald. And rather than repeat these arguments, I will instead use my time to highlight KSWL's policy concerns. As the session draws to a close, legislators are understandably working overtime to shepherd their priority legislation through. Unfortunately, the collateral damage that House Bill 2971 poses is dire, and KS Wild urges those who are reluctantly supporting this bill to please rethink your strategy. Otherwise, the will of the voting citizens of Oregon will be subverted, and hundreds of innocent cougars could needlessly die at the hands of what is basically an armed militia. There is simply no justification for this legislation, and the potential negative consequences are severe. Despite what its supporters say, House Bill 2971 violates the intent of Measure 18. The voters have twice made it clear that they do not support recreational hound hunting, which is what this bill is really about. ODFW can put a badge on a hound hunter and call them an agent, but it's still recreational hunting. Additionally, this bill raises some serious safety and liability issues. I understand that the amendment that we saw for the first time today is attempting to address these issues, but I don't think it quite gets there. I own land in rural southern Oregon, where the pilot project for ODFW's Cougar Management Plan is currently underway, and even ODFW's paid, trained staff aren't capable of conducting their killing within the approved boundaries. 2 months ago, they trapped and killed 3 cougars outside of the management zone. If ODFW can't manage and direct its own staff in a legal manner, how on earth can we expect them to train and oversee armed volunteers? I regularly hike Southern Oregon's trails.
I'm only going to be able to give you another 30 seconds.
I'm almost done. All trails right. In backcountry with my dog, and the passage of this bill, frankly, doesn't make me feel safe. This use of volunteer armed agents could result in significant financial liabilities for the state in the form of private property rights complaints, damage to private property, and the potential for accidents involving the general public. I urge you to oppose it.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Jim Ince, Barbara Wilson, and then somebody from the Mackler-Molesky-Greenwald crew. No, they're right there. They're right there. That's okay. Thanks for looking out for them. And before, Barbara, before you go, you in the black shirt there, is that your girl next to you there?
Yes.
Did she come to testify? I see her very engaged and shaking her head, or is she just here to watch? Together? Okay. You'll come up next. What's your name?
Carolyn
Tillar. Okay.
Should I start?
Yeah,
I'm Barbara ahead. Wilson. I live in Beaverton. I'm chairperson of Friends of Mount Hood, which is a conservation group that's located in Parkdale, Mount Hood, Hood River, Portland, in my city, Beaverton. We are very much opposed to this bill. I had a statement that was timed for 2 minutes, but I did want to spend time on something that Representative Roblin said that raised my blood pressure, if you'll excuse me. These wildlife are not moving into settled areas. People are building homes in cougar territory, and cougars come back to the territory that they thought was theirs. So I felt that was a very false statement. Also, you said not to talk about Measure 18, but this really is a violation of Measure 18 because it talks about extra people in the woods with dogs and using their bait. My group believes in the beauty and magnificence of wildlife. We do not view a cougar as a nuisance animal. We view him as a gorgeous creation that is here for ecological value in the natural order of the natural world. We specifically object to the policy of ODFW in that they are complaint driven. And yet when you get down to the complaints, many of them, and this was mentioned by Representative Roblin, the complaints may be driven by sightings. Suddenly sightings become a matter of concern. A cougar can enter your property and not be a threat and not be present you with imminent danger. It concerns me that ODFW states Oregon has 5,100 cougars, and they won't. Their statement is they won't let the population fall below 3,000. So what do they have in mind for the 2,100 between 5,100 and 21? That sounds like perhaps 3,000.
I'm going to have to cut you off. We're going to need to move on.
So these are my comments, and I will submit.
Good. I would like you to
please vote no on this very bad bill. It is not what it appears to be. It's
do you have copies of what you brought in writing with you? Good.
Yep.
I'd like the committee members to have that.
Thank you.
Mr. Ince, I'm only going to be able to give you about a minute, but please go ahead.
Well, I've come 150 miles. That's 300 miles round trip. It's too bad you're only giving me a minute.
Well, I'll do the best I can, but we're going to be called out of here by the Senate President in about 7 minutes, and so. Pull the microphone over and give us your name for the record.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Avakian and committee members. My name is James Ince. I own and operate a 160-acre ranch surrounded by the Umpqua National Forest in Douglas County. Today I want to impress upon you my experiences with my neighbors, the Cook Ranch, and I have had since 1962 running cattle and horses on our collective 1,000 acres in prime bear and cougar habitat. The most striking observation I have to share with you that in spite of our homes being at the center of some of the highest cougar and bear traffic in the state of Oregon, we have not observed any predation on our herd since 1962. During these 45 years, the livestock herds have typically range from 30 to 50 head of cattle with 30 cow-calf pairs. Indeed, there have been no recorded deaths attributed to cougar in Oregon. In short, it is abundantly clear that there is no need to institute additional cougar management interventions, particularly through the unscientific Rube Goldberg proposal to deputize the houndsmen of all people as ODF&W agents to indiscriminately cull 2,000 probably innocent cougar. By the way, the hunters, and I'm acquainted with a lot of them, who don't run hounds, typically stand united against hound hunting as a general, in general as an inhumane and unsporting behavior. At the end of the day, the important and compelling reasons that Oregon voters twice affirmed Measure 18 have not been changed. The bottom line is that there is a tremendous amount of misinformation being fed to our legislators here. The best credible science belies the propaganda regarding expanding cougar numbers and since the advent of Measure 18. In fact, scientists are generally of one mind on just how self-regulating these predators are when it comes to their population. Thus, the proposed massive kill-off of thousands of innocent cougar by the agent houndsman, again, according to the best science, likely bring about a precipitous decline in mature cougar populations, leaving dispersing additional juveniles to fill the vacuum habitat, causing teenager mischief. This is a documented phenomenon. Summing up, ODF&W is in over its head with the ill-conceived cougar management plan and is putting all its eggs in the houndsman basket. Problem is that there is no credible, compelling evidence before the legislature to justify your categorically violating the will of the people. I urge you to reject HB 2971 and terminate this ill-advised cougar management plan. The point of this bill, ODF&W makes hundreds of thousands of dollars, tremendous amounts of money from the sale of honey, including Baron Cougar tags. Thus, the bill is unnecessary. It would enlist volunteers lacking proper credentials and motivations when professionals from within the scientific community could be more appropriately hired to deal with any emerging issues which at present do not exist. Thank you.
Sorry, I pushed you to read so quickly. The content was actually excellent, and while you were doing that, I also read the paragraph you weren't able to get in. Good. Thank you for making the
I'm
trip.
I'm sorry that I had to make that so abrupt, but I was forced to. Came a long way.
I understand. Go ahead.
Okay, my name's Sally Mackler. Thank you for the opportunity to address you, however briefly today. I've come from Jackson County, rural Jackson County, representing the Sierra Club's 24,000-plus members. Today we're urging you to vote no on House Bill 2971. This bill is simply not needed.
About 2,000 more. I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
The bill is simply not needed. It's a solution searching for a problem. The Cougar Management Plan was approved a year ago, in case you did not realize that. There's no reason for you to be dealing with this issue whatsoever or to be even considering violating the will of the voters at this point. The plan was approved a year ago, and the plan has a budget to hire agents, a budget that was written by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, a budget that costs the taxpayers not one dime. So this bill is not saving the taxpayers a penny. The budget comes from the Department of ODF&W. ODF&W has sold 39,719 tags in 1 year, grossing hundreds of thousands of dollars. The cost to implement the plan for the fiscal year 07 is $121,770. My point is the Cougar Management Plan was approved. It has a budget. There's an ample source of funds from that budget and an appropriate source of funds from that budget, which is the revenue from cougar tags. So there's no reason for you to even be dealing with this issue and treading on the will of the voters. This does violate Measure 18 because it is indiscriminate killing of cougars. Measure 18 addressed the issue of damage and allowed the use of bait and hounds only for dealing with damage and public safety issues. That was the intent and the spirit of Measure 18. And it is being violated by this because the Cougar Management Plan, which this bill directs agents to be implementing, is the indiscriminate killing of cougars. Cougars in a target area will be killed whether they created damage or not. There's absolutely no determination that they have caused any harm whatsoever. The way these areas are delineated is by the use of complaints over a 13-year period. NOAA will address how unreliable that is as criteria. And also damage kills, which are when a rancher kills a cougar that has damaged his cattle or his sheep. Those cats are already dead. So you're going into a circumscribed area using unreliable data and just basically killing any cat that happens to be there. This does not address an emergency situation, which is potentially where there may be a need of assistance. This bill just simply does not address that. The amendment to the bill may help very marginally, but it is not free. There's going to be a cost involved with the administration of the administrative issues that are brought forward with the amendment, and also the statistic analysis that you mentioned will also cost money. So I would suppose and suggest that this go to the Ways and Means Committee, because this is not a free lunch. Opponents may say it's free, but it's not free. There's going to be a cost involved with this. We were promised by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and it says in the Cougar Management Plan that they will work within the law, that they that voters twice said that hounds may not be used to hunt, and the plan abides by that determination. And apparently, they've changed their mind now. They also promised me...
Mr. Greenwald going to want to testify?
Yes, he is. I just want to address some claims that were made very quickly. HB 2971 does not provide ODF&W with any more tools. They have had the ability to stage damage hunts without dogs. They have that ability, and they have not done so. They have had opportunity to define agents and the use of bait and hounds for emergency situations for over a decade. They have not taken advantage of that. They have not spent one penny to provide assistance to a property owner who has a problem by providing them with assistance with the use of bait and hounds. So it has absolutely nothing to do with that. As far as verified complaints go, I beg to differ. In your packet is a sample complaint form, which you will see from 2004. This is one of many that have come from my district. The complainant states, "Cougar assumed to have eaten her two cats. Verification, yes. No agent sent. Listed as verified." So I beg to differ with that. One other thing that I want to mention is that Oregon is now killing more cougars in the state than it ever has in its entire history. 442-plus cats were killed last year as opposed to 204 cats in 1994 and 93. I rest my case. You don't need this bill. We oppose it, and it is a violation of Measure 18.
Mr. Greenwald, I am, before we end today, going to get Ms. Teller and her daughter up here to testify. So if you could keep it brief, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Vakian. I'm Noah Greenwald. I'm a conservation biologist with the Center for Biological Diversity. I urge you to vote no on 2971. This bill allows for implementation of the Cougar Management Plan. There's too many questions about the Cougar Management Plan at this time to pass this bill. Namely, the Cougar Management Plan relies on several untested and problematic assumptions. One, that the cougar population is increasing. Two, that they can estimate the size of the cougar population reliably. And three, that killing cougars will result in reduced damage and reduced complaints. The reason why they can't rely on these assumptions is that they don't have the right kind of data. They're relying on complaints and harvest to estimate the population size and to estimate that the cougar population is increasing. The problem with that is that you have to have some estimate of sample effort. If you're assuming that increased harvest means increased cougars, you have to know how much effort's been put into the harvest to make that assumption. They do not have that data, so they do not have a reliable estimate of the population. And in fact, a study that was published in the Journal of Wildlife Management called Cougar Population Dynamics and Viability in the Pacific Northwest came to basically this conclusion, and this is for an area of Northeast Washington and Idaho and Canada, and they looked at cougar populations, and this was in an area where there was increasing complaints, and it was assumed that the cougar population was increasing. So some researchers went out there and actually radio collared and actually counted the cougars and determined what their population trend was through valid methods. And they determined, our research indicates that wildlife managers should not assume that increasing cougar complaints correspond with increasing cougar populations. Indeed, increased complaints may accompany a rapidly declining population as shown here. Furthermore, increased hunting could actually result in increased cougar complaints because of the younger age structure of the cougar population and the higher proclivity of young animals to encounter humans and cause complaints. So this is, you know, a research article that's basically concluding that that what ODF&W did, which is to rely on increased complaints and increased harvest to say that there's increase in cougars, is not a valid method of determining that there is, in fact, more cougars. And that's highly problematic. So I would encourage you to vote no on 2971 and encourage ODF&W to take the time to do proper studies and determine what our cougar population in Oregon is actually doing before they go out and kill cougars. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you both very much. Ms. Teller, why don't you come up and bring your girl with you? And for everybody else who's here, these can be the last two that are going to be up today because we are already late for getting to the Senate floor. And for those of you who drove a while, I am sorry that we couldn't get you up, but that happens occasionally. Just go ahead and tell us your name for the record, and then go right ahead.
All right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Carolyn Tillar.
Ms. Tillar, could you hang on just a second? Mm-hmm. We are now...
Can we just listen?
I was just going to explain. We are under a call of the Senate, which means we're being called up there and have to go. But we're going to take 1 minute to have your daughter give her name and say what she wants to say, okay?
Well, my name is Anne MacDonald, and I know that the best way to prevent conflict has been proven to be education, and that I've been killing off cougars, and that female cougars are pregnant most of the time they're mature, and cougars can leap about 23 feet from a standstill position.
Where do you go to school?
Actually, I homeschool, and I go to Village Home, and I'm basically in fourth grade.
Where are you from?
Beaverton, Oregon.
From Beaverton? Well, that's very good. I'm very glad you came. It's your first time at the Capitol?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, she's not sure, but...
yeah, I came here for the House Committee.
Even if it's not your first time, I'm very glad that you came here today. And
And
your testimony is very helpful to the committee, so we appreciate you doing that.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, we're going to have to close the public hearing on 2971. As we got into the testimony and close to the hour here, I was not going to move us to a work session anyway today, but certainly we are not going to be able to do it now since we are under the call of the Senate. So with that, we will adjourn.